the beauty of preservation is it both tells this long story and a complex story, which is, you know, who we are as people, right? Like, we are complex individuals. And of course, our histories will be and should be complex as well.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants, the podcast that makes adaptive reuse exciting, accessible, and sustainable for every building owner. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and a champion of reusing existing buildings. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. This week's episode is a condensed replay of an event I had the honor of emceeing back in May, the 10th anniversary celebration of the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Hope Crew. Hope Crew, which stands for Hands-On Preservation Experience, was one of the first and largest efforts to expand the preservation industry in the country. And the mission of Hope Crew is to empower a new generation of preservationists. Since 2014, Hope Crew has trained more than 800 young people and veterans, engaged over 3,000 volunteers in historic preservation trades, and completed nearly 200 projects in cities, parks, and communities across America. These projects include sites such as Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument in Montana, to Nina Simone's childhood home in Tryon, North Carolina, to Estate Little Princess in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. The live stream back in May featured a moderated conversation between Monica Rhodes, who was the founding director of Hope Crew and is the president and founder of Rhodes Heritage Group, and Milan Jordan, who is the current director of Hope Crew. The live stream also featured a reflection discussion with Molly Baker, who's one of the most senior tenured employees with the program, and it ended with three panels, one panel featuring members from the foundation and organizational partners, another panel featuring past Hope Crew participants, and the final panel featuring the trades professionals who spent time providing the training to the participants. The live stream was such a fun event, and this episode is a condensed audio-only version of the event to commemorate the anniversary and share this amazing program with more people. The episode will feature snippets from each of those panels, and the panelists that you'll hear from will include Marie Walker, who's the COO of the CORE Network, Mike Muckle, who's the Executive Director of the New Jersey Youth Corps of Phillipsburg, Chantel Gray Eyes, who's a Program Director at the Conservation Legacy, and Alicia Spence, who's the founder of Spence Timberworks. Be sure to check out the show notes for this episode, which will include links to contact Hope Crew if you have a project you'd like help on, as well as some resources to connect you to other trades professionals. If you have any young people in your life who are interested in the trades, be sure to check out the resources to connect them to programs that may feed their curiosity. And while you're in the show notes, also be sure to sign up for our newsletter so you can get tips right to your inbox. So without further ado, please enjoy this condensed replay of the 10th anniversary celebration of Hope Crew at the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the 10th anniversary celebration of the National Trust for Historic Preservation's Hands-On Preservation Experience Program, better known as Hope Crew. My name is Nikita Reed, and I am a preservation architect and senior associate at Quinn Evans, one of the largest women-owned architecture firms in the country that specializes in historic buildings. I'm also the host of the Tangible Remnants podcast, and there's a podcast that demystifies the process of transforming historic buildings into thriving spaces to honor their past while serving their present. I have the distinct honor of being the MC of today's celebration, as we bring together the many people who've been involved with Hope Crew. We're going to hear from the past and present directors of Hope Crew, and we're going to hear directly from those who've been involved with the program, including partner organizations, trades professionals, and participants. I am pleased to introduce Milan Jordan, the current director of Hope Crew at the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Hi, Nikita. Thank you so much. Thank you for the wonderful introduction and for kicking everything off. And hello, everyone in the audience. Thank you so much for being here today for this 10th anniversary birthday party. So I'll just get us started on this event. Nikita did a wonderful job summarizing everything that we're going to see today. And we truly do want this to be a conversation. We want to hear from your voices in the chat, and we wanted to hear from a lot of voices throughout the years of the program as well, too. And as Hope Crew reflects on 10 years in the profession, we wanted this to be a look at how the landscape has changed in 10 years. I think the main value in any of these conversations is for anybody locally to figure out how programs like this can exist in your backyard, how you can help impact the trades, and learn the resources that you might need and considerations to help programs be successful. And we've seen a lot in the past 10 years, a lot of administration changes. We've seen a pandemic. The world looks different than it did 10 years ago. A lot of programs have come into existence. Some no longer exist. So it is truly a look and a conversation on the larger preservation trades landscape that we're looking to have today. And we're hoping to share some of the creative ways that we've had to be nimble to continue evolving in our ever-changing world that exists. And that nimbleness is really important in any program that exists, whether it's trades related or just general preservation, education, everybody has to continue to adapt. And I hope you learned something today that helps you figure out how to adapt an idea of yours to give it a little bit more resilience so that it can continue living on into the future. So we're going to bring on Monica, the founding director of the program, to hear from her as well, too, before we get the conversation started.
So I'm super excited to be here. As Milan has shared, you know, I can't believe it's been a whole decade since we initially started this program. And I remember just like it was yesterday when at the time under the leadership of Stephanie Meeks at the National Trust, joined by Terry Ritchie and Destry Jarvis, got together to envision what would it look like if we thought more expansively about who gets to participate in the past. And then how do we also address deferred maintenance in the Park Service? And so being at this critical juncture, both in our nation, but also in the moment of preservation, after we have celebrated some key milestones in our industry's history, that this is a good moment to look back and to see what lessons have we learned. As we'll hear from the panelists today, they come from, you know, California to New York, the age ranges, the experiences, but most importantly with this program, centering the fact that everyone belongs in this history, belongs to this story. And as you see throughout the history of this program, that there has been, it's a microcosm of the expansiveness and the depth of our nation. So very proud to have kicked off this effort and to be in conversation, Milan, with you as well as Nikita today.
I am so thrilled to have you both here. This is going to be a fun conversation, and I want us to just dig right in. And I want to get into some of the nitty-gritty. We will absolutely talk about the impact that this had on the profession. But before we get into that, we got to take a look back. And so let's talk a little bit about the past and where Hope Crew started. So Monica, take us back to the early days.
Tell
us more about what inspired the trust to start Hope Crew, and what was your biggest challenge of getting it off the ground? I think it had something to do with the t-shirt.
Thanks, Nikita, for that. So, yeah, Hope Crew, as I mentioned, was started actually in the marketing department of the National Trust that was really focused in on bringing more young people into the preservation trades. So, you know, we knew, as I mentioned earlier, that the Park Service had a deferred maintenance backlog of, you know, over $10 billion at the time. So that was, you know, that was a policy problem issue, but there was also this human gap that existed with not enough people coming into the preservation trades. That's something that I will say that the preservation community has not kept our eye on the ball of that. I think we've done a good job with training our preservation planners and our preservation architects, but we haven't done the best job of investing in the next generation of preservation professionals. And this program was the answer to that, because if we look at Notre Dame in Paris, you know, they had some challenge in identifying that. And I think about if we were to use some of our most iconic sites or something were to happen, then we would be in that same boat there. We're already there, right? So that was the point of kicking off a program like this, to expand who gets to participate in preserving the past and more importantly, who gets to be a part of the future of the country. And so the program just kind of evolved from there. We initially thought it was going to be a volunteer program. So I was hired as the manager of volunteer outreach. And our first project was actually in Hinchliffe, Paterson, New Jersey, at a stadium called Hinchliffe. And through that experience and having 700 volunteers repaint the interior of a Negro League baseball stadium in a few hours, actually. It wasn't even a full day. You know, it demonstrated that there was this need and a desire for people to actually touch the history that's in their community. But we didn't stay there. We then, you know, shifted our focus, or doubled the focus rather, on thinking through, well, how do you pay and train young people to get those skills to be able to preserve these historic resources that we know are so important? So we started to pay people to do that. And the Core Network was a critical partner in helping us connect to young people across the country who were already doing trail work. And what we did was just overlay preservation trades to that. So it's been incredibly helpful to have all of these partnerships to do that, because there was, you know, while the trust was the leader and envisioned this out, it would have not been possible without the vision, the support, the connection, and the partnership to organizations around the country that saw the need in getting involved in the preservation space.
What was some of the feedback or the initial reaction that you were seeing from the preservation community and the trades communities as Hope Crew continued to grow?
So I would say the one project I just mentioned was Hinchliffe Stadium. And that at the time was a focus of the National Trust, and it had been abandoned for about 20 years. And when we did that Hope Crew project, it demonstrated to the city that people actually cared. So they did not demolish it. And now through that and other trust efforts, that stadium was redeveloped for over $100 million. And now it's open to the public. Oh. And if that happened, if it had not been for the program demonstrating that people actually cared about this place. So that people power was real. And that really set the course for the program. But those are important lessons learned, that we were focused in on expanding this conversation to as many people as possible. So yeah, there was some in the preservation space, it was important to have it, but we were also having it with the public that had not been engaged around preservation before. We were having it with veteran communities, veterans. We were having it with people who were returning citizens. We were having it with and created opportunities for people who were deaf or hard of hearing to participate in cleaning headstones or painting something. So we really thought about, what would this industry that is known as a movement of no, what if we ask the question of why not and how can we? And that's what we did. With the trades training side, though, it was a fun time building the support for having young people from 18 to 35 who had never worked on a historic property before, convincing the National Park Service to trust them to maintain that building to preservation standards. But hats off to the preservation leadership within the Park Service, within the National Trust, for seeing that there was an opportunity and also not putting up roadblocks, but figuring out how can we and why haven't we done this, and identifying opportunities to fund young people. So everything that kind of popped up as a maybe we shouldn't, or we've never done this before, or we've never worked with this group before, we turned it right on its head. And we were able to demonstrate the possibility of what could happen when we asked different questions around who gets to participate in this conversation. And then finally, I'll say the third part of Hope Crew was the preservation and practice component, which involved the National Park Service, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and Morgan State University was one of the first HBCUs to participate. And that part also helped to identify preservation architecture students who needed to get experience in the preservation space. Because Nikita, as you know, as a trained architect, if you don't go out looking for preservation, you won't find it in as a part of your curriculum. And so that was a way to really push the conversation, and it created an intervention where we, the next generation of also of architects, were coming in with the lens of not just building new as if our world is what it is, but thinking about how are we thoughtful about reusing what we have, and how are we training our architects to be as thoughtful with us as we move into the future together. So we had that three-pronged approach, and it all worked out great with lessons learned along the way.
Absolutely. And the greenest building is the one that's already built, as Carl Alafonte is often credited as saying. And absolutely, having architects and young people excited about working with our existing and historic buildings is crucial. And that also recognizing that it's not just working with the paper and designing it, it's also building it and working on it with the materials. So I'm super excited to have learned more about the beginnings of Hope Crew. So thank you for sharing. So Milan, why don't we pivot and talk a little bit more about the present? How has the program evolved from its early days and where is it now?
I like to think that it still has all of the initial pillars that Monica developed when the program existed. We have still done volunteer and community events. We still do intro to the trades, and we still have the HBCU engagement, although that has evolved and looks a little different throughout the years. And COVID, when I started at the National Trust, it was March of 2020, and got a note that, oh, there's something going on. We're going to ship your computer to you. You'll be in the office soon. And 4 years later, I have never worked in the office, and stepping in to run an in-person hands-on program amidst a pandemic, stay-at-home orders, people are not gathering, was a major pivot that had to happen for the program. And I know there's a lot of different thoughts about virtual education for hands-on things. There's so much importance in the muscle memory and needing to touch the materials and seeing things with your own two eyes. We have all done iPhone site visits and been surprised when you get there and see the reality of the materials in front of you. So it is very hard to do any of that solely virtually. I think the program has evolved to consider a number of different hybrid options that have allowed us to bring even more people into the fold. One thing anybody else who's ever taken on the honorable and I hope task of paying everybody who participates is that trade training is also not inexpensive. In a consumer society where your dollar is your voice and you want to pay people a livable wage to tell them this work matters, you can't expect them to show up for free and say, yeah, well, this is really important to do. So we have to pay people. Almost all of the costs of Hope Crew go back out the door. They pass through to the materials, to the participants, to the trades experts. So it's not inexpensive. But through the hybrid model, I think we're able to engage more people. We can make the experiences a little longer. We've pulled in layers of research and learning about the place remotely. And then there's that really nice aha moment of having learned about somewhere from afar, read about it, seen pictures of it, heard people who care about it talk about it. And then it's in front of you. And then you go there and then you do some hands-on work. So we've run with the hybrid model for a number of projects and programs throughout the year. Our HBCU engagements have definitely deepened. I think at the point Monica was here at the National Trust, I believe they were working with Morgan State and Tuskegee University and Hampton. So they'd had three of the seven HBCUs with colleges of architecture. And now we've worked with six of the seven. And the experiences just looked really different each year. I think of Hope Crew as a very people-forward program. They're working on historic places, but we really try to create experiences where people can see themselves in the preservation trades. Because one thing we always know through running lots of national conversations, Preservation Priorities Task Force, other national task forces, that as much of a need as there is for trades training, programs still continue to shutter. And you wonder, we have such a shortage of tradespeople. Why aren't people signing up? Why aren't they enrolling? And sometimes there's that initial spark doesn't exist. The incubation that gets people looking for those types of programs and saying, oh my gosh, I can see myself doing this. We certainly fill a bit of that niche because we create really tailored experiences that really tie to people's identities, their cultural heritage. Anybody who may like history may say, I didn't even know this existed. I didn't know people who looked like me lived here. And they learn things that really make the social justice aspect of preservation real for them. And the hands-on layer is a really great one. We've worked with all kinds of students now as well, too. A lot of four-year colleges, we've worked with poli-sci students, history, graphic majors, and everybody has that connection to place when they've learned about it and they go and lay their hands on it. So there's a lot of incubation to happen. So all the three pillars that Monica talked about still exist, and we've evolved, and sometimes our experiences can be longer. We've had 3 month, 6 month fellowships now and been able to work with people for longer because that would be very expensive to do a 6 month on-site fellowship, right. So splitting it up with some research, some networking, some hands-on, some travel has been integral for it. So that's a little bit of a taste of what the program looks like today.
And so then what kinds of projects are the participants typically working on and kind of what skills are they learning?
Yeah, we still run the gamut. In my time, even just being here, they still have masonry projects. We've done carpentry, painting, vegetation removal. We're starting the slideshow now with all the amazing pictures. That's one of my favorite. There are three with Molly there as well, too. It was a really unique masonry project where they're, by way of vernacular architecture, they had the giraffe stone, which was a very unique way of working on and painting the stone there in Oklahoma. And so students can learn about reason behind why buildings look the way they do in their community, and maybe they don't look the way they do somewhere else. So they still do the full the full span of projects, a lot at cemeteries. We did get a little technological in cemeteries. We've done ground penetrating radar. We've done a lot of laser scanning throughout some of the recent years as well, too. So it's really important to just show people the breadth of skills one could employ in the preservation trades. And any one of them may spark an interest of theirs. And there's a whole world that exists there.
Absolutely. And so what are some of the key challenges that you're seeing that are facing the preservation trades workforce today?
I don't think our challenges are, at this present moment, too dissimilar from what a lot of our friends and colleagues are facing: threats to funding, priorities in preservation. There's just kind of the rug being pulled out beneath everyone. Again, threats to AmeriCorps. One of the core pieces of the model that Monica created was the connection with the corps as participants, and adding preservation as an overlay to people who are already learning hands-on trade skills. It's a lot easier to not also have to teach someone how to swing a hammer, but they're already learning hands-on skills, and then you're adding a preservation overlay. And that partnership has been really critical with Job Corps, and the threats that exist to the preservation landscape and all of us who support it has been a major one as of recently. If you'd asked me last year, funding has always been a thing. Trying to get people to pay attention to your cause is always challenging. We can tell the stories and we pull at the heartstrings and we care about it and we speak passionately, but getting people to notice in a very crowded space where everyone's competing for funds can sometimes be challenging. Trying to get them into your cause. I think if there was just money flowing left and right towards preservation trades and education, PTN would be one of the best resource organizations that we have. And it's not necessarily the case. It's very hard to fundraise, and to do so over and over again is certainly a challenge.
Right. And I can imagine that in the shifting political climate and the funding sources changing, the shift is you're likely having to do again from what you had to go from COVID response to now dealing with how do we handle changes in funding so the work can still happen. So have there been any changes in terms of working with cities or other municipalities?
Yeah, so that's some conversations that we've been having. I mean, it seems one sits down and daydreams about what would one expect a national nonprofit organization who is not a trades organization to do to the benefit of trades. One thing that comes to mind for me is certainly helping cities and places develop their infrastructure so that the training can happen locally. As much as I hope we always keep doing singular hope crews or even recurring hope crews at sites, the people need to exist and learn how to do that there. There's so many hope crews where we get called. They even find us because they don't know of anyone in their community who knows how to do this work. So that training needs to happen locally, and it needs to continue happening. It's a continuous thing, not a singular hope crew, not a singular experience or training. Like it needs to be something that exists locally if people want trained professionals to be able to support their historic building stock. So, you know, we have conversations with cities. Hopefully there'll be some new things coming in the works with helping places who have funds and care about their historic sites and know that it is a gap in the resources that they need to steward, that we can help them figure out how to even make the smallest changes to get preservation in front of aspiring preservationists and tradespeople is a great way for them to continue to figure out how to save their own places that matter to them.
Want to learn more about the Unknown Ladies of Architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp!
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools.
women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
And so we have a better sense and understanding now of where Hope Crew is currently. And I'd love for us to talk a little bit about the future. And so, Monica, why don't we start with you? When you look to the future of preservation, share a little bit about what excites you the most.
You know, I was initially going to answer this question and bring in like technology, like Milan's Digital Documentation Fellowship. Like that's an incredible use of new technologies to think about how do you engage with people. But then in addition to that, I'm also thinking about just the real power that preservation has. Right. At the bare minimum, we strip it away. It's really about belonging. And in a country, in a world that's experiencing this loneliness epidemic, even though we're more connected in ways than we've ever been before, you know, I think the innovation in our future is really leaning in on who we really are and what we've been and telling stories about the power that historic sites has to impact and shift and transform how you think. Not only about the world or I didn't know this happened here, but ultimately it's really to shift and transform how you think about yourself, right? So we are in, you know, we're in the building business, but we're also in the identity business here. And I think when we think about the future of it, as we are trying to move and keep up with the AI and the AR, which, you know, are all important, right? We can't leave that. But we also have to lean in on who we are and not forget the power that we have in preserving these places that are central to our identities.
Absolutely. And Milan, what about you? What are you most excited about? And maybe what are some of your hopes for what's next with Hope Crew?
Yeah, I mean, it was a good segue in the last question about helping people save the places that matter for them. I think of a national organization as creating resources for people locally. Like the National Trust is a grant-making organization. I'd love to have a trades grant for people to have trades programs get off the ground in their own communities, for there to be conversations, because no matter how many times we meet and converse and talk, you'd think, oh my gosh, everyone's heard this a million times before. The number of times that people say, wow, I didn't know that, or I wonder if that's why my program didn't work. I think there need to be forums and conversations. I think others need to learn from each other. And IPTW is a great one for people to meet. And sometimes people know of the National Trust and they may not know of smaller organizations. So trying to help with convening, with resources, with getting things on the ground, because I think so much of preservation is grassroots, especially if you are dealing when you're dealing with the bricks and mortar and the actual individuals who need to save the places, it needs to exist locally. So thinking about how we can, you know, not be the savior that comes in and does some work at a place every now and then, like how we can help people save their own places are the resources that I hope Hope Crew as a national brand in trades can help people with locally.
Yeah. And speaking of some of those other local and other types of organizations, this one's for both of you. How do you think that partnerships with these organizations, like the Core Network, like unions and HBCUs, how do you think those can continue to strengthen the pipeline for preservation trades? And what role do you see donors, corporate sponsors, and the broader preservation community playing to continue ensuring the success of Hope Crew's next decade?
I'll say, since we were sharing a little bit about our current climate, I think more people are paying attention now more than ever to the things they just kind of took for granted, like that museum would be there or that place would be there or my child would be able to read this book or that book or just have options, right? Because, you know, the beauty of preservation is it both tells this long story and a complex story, which is, you know, who we are as people, right? Like we are complex individuals. And of course, our histories will be and should be complex as well. And so I see an opportunity, because people are paying more attention to these things, that more donors could be interested in creating opportunities for people to have deeper connections with the past beyond, you know, standing behind the velvet rope and looking at a place. But the more a person can engage with it, these are real connections that people make. And so I see there are opportunities there to raise the visibility and funding around expanding these types of experiences and activations in some ways for people. I also see partnerships continuing to be a critically essential role here, because no one organization, no one person, no one funder, no matter how incredible they are, you cannot do it all. You should not do it all. It's impossible to do it all. So it's incredibly important that doubling down on these partnerships and thinking about, even in the circles that preservationists know, what opportunities are there beyond that in that second or third concentric circle of engagement? What types of organizations are there? So I see space and opportunity to tell deeper stories and demonstrate the value of the work that we have done and will continue to do no matter what.
Yeah, I have such a similar thought. I wouldn't have probably had Monica's beautiful words for it, but to me, the partnership is essential, and none of this could exist without it. Certainly not the trust impact on trades. Like, we don't employ tradespeople. We don't have the materials. We're not habitat. We don't have a training facility. All of this happens through partnership. And there's a lot of gaps that the trust can fill with smaller organizations as well, too. You just never know the way that the skills can come together to a greater benefit. Like, some people, they can't market something, or they're not a grant making organization. They can't pay people. There's all these different ways that we can come together with a similar cause and work together on a program. I imagine that's largely how, when Monica devised Preservation in Practice in partnership with the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation and the National Park Service, it was us taking these different tentacles that we all had and bringing them together to support the future of preservation trades. And that still exists today. Like, we all fill in gaps, because one thing I'm sure anyone who's made any sort of a proposal towards funding in preservation trades, there's the dichotomy that trades training is expensive and you train very few people because you want that low ratio of trades expert to participants. But then people see a very large price tag to train 8 people. So the reach sometimes is a disconnect to a funder's ears. Like, that's a lot of money for 8 people. I could go do this with this organization and reach 10,000. So reach is another way to play around with the visibility and the technology pieces. Like, we've been able to increase the reach in that way as well, too. So I think partnership is absolutely critical. I love when people reach out to us for partnership. I love going in on funding proposals together to fill gaps in what a funder may be looking for, which we are always happy to do. If you have a site, if you want to partner with us on an application, we'd love to work together on it. Sometimes people just need the big name. They say, we're really small. This funder's not going to know who we are. Like, could we partner with you and work on this together? I think none of this could exist without partnership. So it's absolutely critical to me.
Absolutely. And so I hope everyone heard that and were listening. If you have an application, reach out. And this has just been such a fun conversation. And I know that we could talk for hours on this, but we are going to be respectful to everyone's time. But we have a couple more questions before we end the discussion with the directors. And so back to you, Monica. One more question for each of you before we wrap up. What has been the most rewarding moment for you as the founding director of Hope Crew?
Interesting enough, I had the most rewarding moment. It was more in a realization. So it didn't happen while I was at the trust with Hope Crew. It happened after I took a step back and just kind of reflected on it. Because when you're in things, sometimes you don't look up and kind of see it. You understand life by looking backwards. And so reflecting on the program, I realized the excitement that happened when people found out that there was a Hope Crew happening at the same time, or that was, in LA and one in Atlanta and one up in Burlington, Vermont, and one in Missouri. So people were excited to know that they were a part of something bigger than themselves. And so that was a realization for me that, when I started Hope Crew, it was about how cool it is to work on a historic building in the National Park Service that not many people get to touch. Then it became, how cool is it that, I have the great fortune to work for an organization and partner with the National Park Service and the Corps to pay people to do these things. And then it kind of transitioned into, man, you know, we're really shifting how people are connecting with each other. You know, we've had work with, you know, their veterans have been a part of the program. I even met someone who came on a project because he wanted to learn how to preserve headstones because he wanted to help preserve a Confederate cemetery in his hometown where his relatives were buried. So even meeting people across the political spectrum demonstrated to me that people care about the past and they want to have a way to connect with it. Because from my standpoint, the past already belongs to us all, but we don't have equal access to touch it and feel it and to say, I was a part of that, right? We inherit these things, but giving people the option to choose how they can steward that inheritance is the power that Hope Crew was. So these realizations were probably the most powerful for me and memorable, that preservation wasn't just participatory, as I often say, but it's also one of the most patriotic things that people can do, because you are making the decision to be a part of something that came before you and to leave something for people that you'll never meet. And so that is probably my most memorable realization as I think about the importance of programs like Hope Crew.
Yes. And Milan, as you lead Hope Crew into this next chapter, pivoting over to you now, what do you hope your legacy will be?
Legacy. I hope we create a space for somebody else to keep carrying the torch. I hope that there are more trades training programs locally. I don't ever see it as we have to do it all for everyone. We have to be the sole source of where people could come for this training. We should have our brand everywhere. I would love for everybody to be able to get what they need for their own communities through the resources that we have shared. I hope Hope Crew continues to be an inspiration to people. Those aha moments that Monica has mentioned, that Molly and I often talk about, are some of the most heartfelt things. When something clicks for a participant on a site, it's not quantifiable. It's not something you can take to a funder and say, we've had 157 aha moments in the 10 years of Hope Crew, but you feel them when you're there. And it really impacts people. These conversations, when people get inspired to, maybe they tried to create a trades training program, they got discouraged, they couldn't find any funding, they got busy, as people do. I think the inspiration piece of it is really that spark that ignites people to move, that gives them a calling in their heart to move towards something. I think inspiration is very important. And certainly with the conversations and with Hope Crew on the national stage, I always hope that inspiration can continue to spark in others and that people continue to be incubated into the preservation trades field, and that we can continue funneling people into more developed programs, longer programs, more pre-apprentice programs, all the programs that exist, that people could actually make a living in this field and walk off of the site onto a job. I hope that we can help continuing to prime those pipes so they don't dry up and people continue to be interested and engaged and to continue to train.
Yes, I love this. I know I said one more, but okay, seriously, this is the last one for both of you. So then, what's one thing, if you could just pick one, that you want attendees to take away from this conversation, and perhaps any call to actions or next steps you'd like to see someone take?
I hope somebody sees someone on stage that they would like to connect with. You're about to hear from a lot of different people. You're about to see a lot of different faces. Some may be near or far to you, but I hope you see at least one person who you'd like to send a request to on LinkedIn, send them an email, pick their brain, create a relationship, figure out something that they've done that you've always tried to do. I hope that somebody sees something that inspires them to take an action to move their own plans and programs forward.
Yeah, I am hoping that for those that are watching, that you share this conversation out, right? Because it's so often we have these internal discussions and, you know, we talk about great things, powerful things, but we're talking to the amen choir. Mm-hmm. So I am encouraging all of you to share this conversation on social, share it with partners, people that you know are interested in doing programs like this. If someone has a project that would be a great fit for a Hope Crew, if you know someone that's, you know, sitting on $1 million and trying to figure that out, they need to be in discussion with Milan. So send that over to them. So there are that's my hope for this, that you are all inspired to take action and spread the word of how important this program is, and that it has this long legacy, a decade long, of contributing to communities across the country.
Well, Monica, Milan, thank you both so much for sharing Hope Crew's past, present, and future with us. I know I'm looking forward to what's next, both at Hope Crew and in this program.
Hello, all. We are now back with Molly Baker, the manager of Hope Crew, and also the longest serving staff member for the program. Now, Molly doesn't know that I'm going to do this. I'm going to do a little introduction, Molly. So we first met when we were doing a Hope Crew project down in Natchitoches, Louisiana, at the African House, which was also a national treasure of the trust at the time. And during that time, I was inspired by Molly's vision and her commitment to partnerships. People would come to the site. She was embedded in the community. Her commitment to trades training, you could feel it. And so I, at that point, had a chance to meet a lot of people from across the country who were doing projects like this and managing sites. But Molly was special. And so when it came time to do my first hire for Hope Crew, I called her up and wanted to see what she was up to, because I told myself after we untangled some things with the Timber Framers Guild that I will find a way to collaborate with this woman in the future. And so, Molly, I am very happy to be in conversation with you today.
Aw, thank you, Monica. That's such a wonderful comment. I'm so elated that you thought of me when that position became available. And just to add to the conversation on the 10-year anniversary, it's been such an exciting year looking back, but also looking forward of how we want to grow the program. But as you mentioned, when Hope Crew came across my radar, I was managing a historic site at the time. And we had an extremely specific preservation need due to the unique nature of a building that was on site, the African House. It was timber frame construction. It's a one-of-a-kind structure. And we could not find the right person to handle this important building. And it was a mutual friend, a dear friend that we've lost, unfortunately, and colleague Sarah Jackson, who brought Hope Crew to our attention. And the thought that we could use this work, this preservation need, as an opportunity to train new preservation practitioners was thrilling. And the project was such a success. We worked alongside Alicia Spence, a timber framer that you'll get to meet later in the program, for those viewers. It was such a success. And I was left feeling at the end of that project, like, that's what I want to do. I want to figure out how to inspire future preservationists and preservation trades practitioners. And so when the position came up and I threw my name in and Monica hired me, it truly was an honor. And since then, you know, the opportunity to share my passion for trades with a younger and more diverse audience has been so wonderful. And it's really key. Engaging a new generation is really key to making sure the stories that these places tell are here for generations to come. And then, you know, personally, just creating a safe and nurturing environment where someone can see themselves reflected and in the field and be able to try their hand at the work, that's been the honor of my life, to get to do that for people, because it was something that in small ways I experienced as a new preservation trades practitioner coming out of school. But it's not always the case. You know, as a female entering a job site, I wanted to make sure that not only for other women, but all people could see themselves reflected in this field and find a place to learn safely. And that has been just such a great piece of this program that I'm hoping that I continue to get to do for generations to come, for years to come in this field.
We are going to move into the panels and the conversational piece of this portion. And so as you've heard from both Milan and Monica and Molly, the work that Hope Crew has been able to complete over the years would not be possible without the participation of the various foundations and organizational partners to help coordinate, as well as trades professionals to help provide guidance and training, and participants to do the work. So in this first of three panels, we're going to spend time hearing stories and reflections from the foundation's cohort. And so why don't we kick it right off to pass it over to Marie to talk about some of the work that's been happening with some of the youth core infrastructure and some of the public-private partnerships that you've been a part of as well.
Well, I have to say thank you to Destry, because we got a phone call from him and Terry Ritchie at the Trust to help build this plane as we were flying it. We knew where the young people were. We knew what the young people had been doing, and we put our heads together. We came up with the very first Hope Crew project with paid Corps members was at Shenandoah National Park. And we had a group of young people there that worked on restoring the stables. Those young people don't realize, but they were the pioneers that blazed the trail for where Hope Crew is today. We saw probably approximately 85 to 90 to about 100 young people go through core programming of Hope Crew projects across the country. It was an incredible, incredible adventure for them because young people got to see places and spaces that they may have been passing every day and had no idea what those structures meant. And then to go into those structures, to do the masonry work, to do the carpentry work, to do the trail work, to go in to do those projects and to be able to go back home and say, guess what I did today to their families? And then take their families down to where those projects were and say, I helped to restore that. That is a tremendous, tremendous adrenaline rush for those young people to be able to do that. And that's what Hope Crew brought. Hope Crew brought hope to a lot of young people that are still today. Some are working in a park service. Some are doing masonry work for private organizations and agencies. It's been a tremendous, tremendous marriage. We're still joined at the hip. We're still doing it. And I think, and Nikita, I'm not trying to take a role, but this is a great place for Mike Munkle to jump in because he was actually the boots on the ground.
Beat me to it. Take it away, Mike.
Well, thank you, Marie. Thank you, Destry. This is a trip down memory lane for sure. But Marie, you stole my line about, you know, building the plane while we're flying it. Our program, New Jersey Youth Corps, works with young adults in a re-engagement aspect to help them get their high school diploma by engaging them on community service projects. And at a time in which our state leadership had changed, our smaller local programs were kind of set adrift without really too much guidance. And then we leaned really heavily on our relationship with the Corps Network, and they gave us so much by way of resources and support. They identified us as a perfect fit to kind of fit this beautiful partnership in which it engaged our youth in these spaces that were in their backyards that a lot of our youth weren't even aware of. And when we stepped foot into Hinchcliffe Stadium for that first project, 700 people showed up on that one day. And we transformed the entire landscape before us. And then we're able to meet family members of former Negro League players, which were just, it was a moving experience to talk to Larry Doby's grandson and then to walk the base paths that his father had ran. Marie knows this about me. I have a very low threshold for joy, but that was a day which kind of catapulted me into this new realm. And working with Monica was absolutely inspiring. Her leadership, her passion for this field, and her knowledge base was just incredible. And that led us to the Hope Crew project down at Sandy Hook. That restoration project at the time, we didn't know really what we were stepping into. Thank you very much, Marie, for kind of keeping a couple secrets from us. But the technical applications were far beyond anything that were capable of our program. But under the guidance of historic preservation experts and local contractors that were well-schooled, they were patient with our members. They shared information readily and passionately about this. And it really gave a lot of purpose in our program at the time when we really needed it. And that just sort of has flourished into this natural progression of wanting to do more and expanding outside of our comfort zone.
All right. Well, we are on to our second panel, and we get to hear from the participants who are involved with doing the work at Hope Crew. And so the question that I will pose for each of you to answer is, how has participating in Hope Crew shaped your personal connection to cultural or historical sites, and especially when those places reflect your own identity, community, or heritage? And how about we start with Shanto on this, and we'll just go around.
Thank you, Nikita.
Yeah, so my personal history with the Hope Crew was started in 2015. It was the Petrified Forest National Park. It was actually the visitor center, the Desert Retreat Center, was designed as the National Park Service Project 66 initiative. So this was a building that was designed by Richard Neutro back in the early 60s. And we were poised to repaint the visitor center under the direction and the guise and the guidance of David Charlebois. And we spent time interacting with the visitors of the center, and you know, curious bystanders and visitors of the park just coming up and asking us questions, and you know, us being able to interact with them. It was really impactful, and it was a really good project. And the Petrified Forest National Park or National Monument is actually just about an hour from Flagstaff, so it's just proverbial down the road, down Highway 40. So yeah, it's just an overall really good experience, and engaging with conservation or programs is crucial for, you know, providing those that skill based development and workforce sort of readiness that the Hope Crew is all about. So definitely had a really good time.
Right. Well, we've heard from the foundations, we've heard from the participants, and now we get to hear from the tradespeople who provided the guidance during the work. So I'm just going to ask one question, and I will let you all answer it. And so the question for you all is, how has hands-on preservation work, whether through mentorship, trades, training, or leading local projects, helps pass down knowledge while building pride and capacity within your communities that you're working in? Alicia, what about you?
Well, I've been working in the timber frame field for a couple of decades now. And, you know, my trade was nearly annihilated by the nail gun. And to learn how to do it, I mean, we had to do forensic research even to get back up to par with what's going on. And I think if I were to impart anything, it is that good work finds grace. And if we're going to preserve these buildings, we also need to bring up the tradespeople. And all of it brings a wonderful connectedness. And it's been a lifetime of learning for me. And I really enjoy, best about Hope Crew is giving people a place at the table.
Amazing.
Oh, here we are. Thank you so much, Nikita, for moderating all of the conversations. I really hope everyone in the audience heard something, learned something, saw someone that made the preservation trades a little bit more relatable to you. If you are a tradesperson, I hope you saw a friendly face that you're familiar with. And we'll end by saying that through all these stories, I hope that you can see the importance of making preservation relatable, and to Mike's final comments, broadening the tent and drawing more people into the fold. I think there are so many unassuming preservationists who don't even know that that is what they are. We meet them every day. People stewarding historic sites that don't think of themselves as historic places. Preservationists, they just thought this place mattered, or I always walked past this place when I was a kid. There's just so much language that can be a barrier to drawing people into the fold. And I really hope that we can continue allowing more people in and not creating barriers so that more people can see themselves in the movement. Would love for you to have us follow us on social media, Hope Crew, and Saving Places is the National Trust's Instagram handle. There's always information there about grant programs, about where we are out in the world doing projects. Sometimes we have takeovers from fellows or crew members. So that's always a great place to keep in touch.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Until next time. Remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.